John Bachman, who pierces people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my drum?
Now the N is for not, oh no, my phone's just sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Mukitas, who plays a sour note. W is Tiasis, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Wednesday, June 20th, 2012. Cross-border fire has continued on Wednesday, with Israeli media outlets reporting that approximately a dozen homemade shells and Grad missiles were fired from the Gaza Strip. In the meantime, Israeli sources said the military has killed a Palestinian fighter in Rafah. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Israeli sources reported that Palestinian resistance groups fired a number of shells from the Gaza Strip against Israeli targets. Most of the shells fired fell in the Negev Desert, but two did fall inside town limits, Haaretz reports. No casualties or injuries were reported, although light damage was sustained to a building used for industrial purposes. Following the attack, Israeli Air Force planes shelled a motorcycle in Rafah, killing its rider. Israel told Reuters that the motorcyclist was involved in Monday's clash between fighters in the Sinai Peninsula in Egypt and Israeli military. Also, the Israeli Air Force carried out several airstrikes overnight and early dawn hours Wednesday, targeting various parts of the Gaza Strip, leading to at least three injuries among the civilian population. Local sources reported that at least one missile was fired at a car driving near a mosque in the Az-Zaytun neighborhood. No injuries were reported as the driver of the vehicle managed to escape before impact. The army also bombarded a blacksmith workshop in the neighborhood, damaging the building and injuring one Palestinian. A resistance training camp in the Sudania area near Gaza City was also targeted by several missiles, while a similar attack targeted a training camp in Rafah in the southern part of the Gaza Strip. Eyewitnesses reported that the army also fired missiles at a group of resistance fighters east of Gaza City, leading to two injuries. On Wednesday morning, the army bombarded Wadi Salka, south of Deir al-Balah in central Gaza. A 17-year-old youth identified as Yahya Hattab was injured. On Tuesday evening, a 2-year-old Palestinian baby identified as Hadil Ahmed Haddad was killed, while her brother suffered moderate injuries and was moved to a local hospital for treatment. The Israeli missiles and shells targeting the Gaza Strip led to the death of 7 Palestinians in the last 48 hours, and dozens were reported injured, some seriously. In other news, the Israeli government of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu reached an agreement with the settlers of Olpana, an authorized outpost near the central West Bank city of Ramallah, stating that Israel will build 300 apartment units for Jewish settlers in exchange for relocating 5 illegal houses. Israeli Ynet News reported that Zalman Melamed, the rabbi of Beit El settlement, and representatives of the Israeli government reached the deal on Tuesday. The 5 illegal homes will be relocated within the settlement boundaries, and in return Israel will construct 300 units on what it calls state land. The 5 homes in question were built by Israel's admission on privately owned Palestinian lands. The settlers will leave their homes in a week. That's all from IMEMC News. This was the Wednesday, June 20th daily roundup news from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by Hussam Kassis and me, George Ishmael.
As Egyptians went to the polls in the second and final round of their nation's first free election for president on June 16th and 17th, the military announced a series of decrees which crushed the hope that was born in last year's democratic revolution. Although millions of Egyptians placed their trust in the military for their role in ousting Hosni Mubarak after decades of one-party rule, it's now the generals who are clearly blocking a transition to democracy. As it became apparent that the Muslim Brotherhood's candidate, Mohamed Morsi, would likely defeat Mubarak's last prime minister, Ahmed Shafik, for the presidency, the military decreed an immediate dissolution of Egypt's elected Islamist-controlled parliament after a Supreme Constitutional Court ruling found the law governing recent legislative elections was unconstitutional. As polls closed on June 17th, a second decree gave the generals total control over governmental and military affairs until new parliamentary elections are held. The Supreme Council of Armed Forces, or SCAF, also announced that if the existing Constituent Assembly failed to complete its work to draft a new constitution, the SCAF will form its own Constituent Assembly to write a constitution within 3 months. Tens of thousands of Egyptians responded to the Muslim Brotherhood's call for a protest against the military in Cairo's Tahrir Square on June 19th. Meanwhile, ousted President Hosni Mubarak was reported to have suffered a stroke on June 19th and was close to death. Your reporter spoke with Phyllis Bennis, director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. She discusses the Egyptian military's counter-revolution and the role the U.S. could play to support democracy.
Moments, really, after the final part of the election, when it became clear that the Muslim Brotherhood had won, and quite overtly in response to the possibility of a Muslim Brotherhood president, the military announced that the president would essentially have virtually no power, that the president that was about to be elected would not be able to control the army, would not be the supreme commander of the military, would not be in control of the military budget, would have no oversight over the overall budget, would not have the right to declare war, and essentially would be only a figurehead. It was the most egregious, most overt sign of an absolute pullback from the military's claim that they intended to turn over power to civilian rule as soon as anybody could be elected, because, after all, they didn't really want to be in charge. They were just doing it out of patriotic duty, and they thought they had to, and as soon as they could, they were going to hand power back to an elected authority. Well, when time came to hand it back to an elected authority, it turned out they didn't like the elected authority so much, so they simply announced, we're not going to do it.
Phyllis, is there any evidence that the U.S. is covertly supporting the Egyptian military in an effort to contain Islamist political forces in the Arab world's most important nation?
I think there's no question that the U.S. financially and militarily is supporting the Egyptian military. They have for 30 years, and they never stopped, including during and after the Arab Spring. Now, having said that, I have not seen any evidence or even any substantial allegations that the U.S. is actually orchestrating this coup. I think the U.S., the Obama administration, would be quite happy with a stable government in civilian government in Egypt, because it's more likely to encourage greater stability in this most important Arab country. And the U.S., I think, has grudgingly, I would say, come to terms with the fact that Islamist forces of various sorts, and the Muslim Brotherhood in particular in Egypt, are critical forces that have massive support from the population, despite their claims of, you know, they would never meet with terrorist organizations, etc., and they have for many years included the Muslim Brotherhood in several countries on various lists of so-called terrorism. The U.S. officials, the State Department, has been meeting with representatives of the Muslim Brotherhood. They were here in April. They spent several days in Washington meeting at very high levels with the State Department and other parts of the administration, as well as with members of Congress. I don't think the U.S. necessarily believes that only through an overt military coup of this sort could they maintain control. Their issue is control and stability, relations with Israel, etc. I think that what they don't want to see is a repeat of the massive instability that comes with activism in the street on the level that we saw for 18 days during Tahrir Square last year. So I don't know that the U.S. directly is orchestrating this. What is undoubtedly true is that U.S. military and financial support has enabled the Egyptian military, has strengthened the Egyptian military, and has given them the independent power to move like this on their own. And what is clear is that so far, at least, the U.S. has done nothing to restrain them.
What would be the path forward for the Obama administration in terms of how to react to these dramatic moves by the Egyptian military that would both support democracy and stability in Egypt, as well as retaining some ties to the Egyptian military, which, of course, continues to play a very influential role in events there?
Well, I think, you know, the point of investing huge amounts of money and training and arming and all those things in militaries around the world is precisely to influence them. And this is the moment to do it. So I would say the way forward should be, if we're talking about what's likely, but if we're talking about what should be, what we should see is a decision by the U.S. administration to announce publicly to the Egyptian military, you know that $1.3 billion we've been giving you every year? You can kiss that goodbye until you go back to your barracks and allow the elected leadership of this country to take full power, including power over you. You don't tell an elected government what to do. They tell you what to do. And in the meantime, we're going to take that $1.3 billion and we're going to send it to the parliament, so they can use it to help rebuild the country, to help recreate an economy that's not based on foreign banking interests, but is based on the interests of the Egyptian people. Now, that's idealism. That's not going to happen. But if we're looking for solutions of what could happen, what could transform the situation, that kind of major shift is what's required to match the kind of major shift that has happened in Egyptian politics, symbolized by the uprising itself.
That was Phyllis Bennis, director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. Find more news and analysis on the turmoil surrounding Egypt's transition to democracy on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
Afghanistan, Monday. Three men dressed as Afghan police opened fire on U.S. troops, killing one and wounding nine before disengaging and getting away clean. This has happened over and over again this year, especially since the Quran burning incident. Afghanistan, Tuesday. NATO is reporting the death of a soldier of unspecified nationality from an insurgent attack in an undisclosed location in southern Afghanistan. Afghanistan, today. A suicide bomber attacked a NATO military convoy as U.S. troops were carrying out what were described as vehicle checks. In other words, setting up a checkpoint to do the Afghan version of stop and frisk earned the wrath of an Afghan suicide bomber. The military is not owning up to any casualties among their own forces, but four civilians were killed. Afghanistan, yesterday, insurgents attacked a police checkpoint in Kandahar province, killing three cops and wounding six more. Fighting went on for nearly an hour with small arms. Afghanistan, yesterday, a drone crashed in eastern Kunar province. No word on whether it was shot down. Afghanistan, yesterday, insurgents launched an attack on a NATO camp in Shah Wali Khan district. At least 10 NATO soldiers of unspecified nationality were wounded. Seven insurgents were killed. Few details of this attack have been released. Was this another truck bomb plus infantry job, like that massive 1st of June attack that wounded 130 U.S. soldiers and killed two? Mr. Barack Obama, you cannot win this war, just as George W. Bush was unable to win in Iraq. Now is the time to pull the plug, bring all the troops home today.
And no amount of money you could give me, honey, couldn't pay me, ain't going back again. I ain't going back again. I ain't going back again. You won't see me back there again. No, you won't see me back there again.
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange has taken refuge in or is otherwise under the protection of the Ecuadorian embassy in London after a British government refused his last appeals against extradition to Sweden. Sweden says they want to lock him up without a trial. That extradition, in turn, would expose him to extradition to the U.S., where he is considered a wartime enemy for blowing the whistle on things like U.S. helicopter gunships mowing down civilians in Iraq in the infamous collateral murder video. Sweden has already handed prisoners over to the U.S. and has been found by the U.S. to be complicit in U.S. torture as a result of turning two men over to the CIA in 2006. To know how the U.S. would treat Julian Assange, one need only look at the treatment Bradley Manning, who is accused of feeding documents to WikiLeaks, is getting. It was over a year from when he was arrested until his first court appearance, all of it in solitary confinement, most of it in Quantico Marine Barracks surrounded by enemies. If a Republican gets into the White House, even Guantanamo Bay would not be out of the question for Mr. Assange. Therefore, Julian Assange is now under the protection of the Embassy of Ecuador, a nation that has good relations with Venezuela and others who disapprove of U.S. torture and imperialism. Activists around the world hope Ecuador will formally grant asylum to Julian Assange, just as the U.S. did for the famous blind Chinese activist Mr. Chen. Six young people have been arrested by the pigs in Quebec, Canada, for allegedly shutting down a variety of government and corporate websites. The government won't even admit to whether or not they're being accused of carrying out operations against a Canadian Grand Prix for Anonymous, though there was widespread speculation that those are the charges. The Canadian government is a target of Anonymous because of Bill 78, an extremely repressive anti-protest law aimed at student protesters and those who bang pots and pans in the streets to support them. Here is an overall update on the situation in Quebec, Canada. Months ago, students in Montreal rose in revolt, walked out of classes, and shut down the universities to protest a proposed doubling of tuition. The government responded with emergency legislation called Bill 78 to criminalize the protests and expose protesters to serious jail time, but that fed the flames of revolt and spread the uprising to entire communities. Even the United Nations has condemned Canada over Bill 78. Into this volatile mix was thrown the Canadian Grand Prix, a running of the most expensive form of auto racing in the world. Shortly before, another Grand Prix was run in Bahrain, in defiance of global calls for a boycott of that repressive regime, one that has slaughtered protesters just like in Syria. You may remember the 2002 so-called Grand Prix in D.C., which was not even a real Formula One race. Organizers promised sound walls, instead provided cloth barriers to prevent neighbors from watching the race from outside the fence. The fence was cut, and a squatters section opened on a hill above the track. The response to the Canadian Grand Prix was far more intense, with waves of protesters seeking to shut down areas near the Grand Prix. Police responded by arresting anyone they thought might be a protester, even profiling people wearing the red squares of cloth symbolizing the student movement or any black clothing. Into this conflict came cyberspace support from Anonymous, which shut down a number of websites in Quebec associated with the Grand Prix. These attacks were claimed as retaliation for Bill 78's criminalization of peaceful protest. Anonymous also issued this warning to wealthy race fans in the form of a Notice to Grand Prix Visitors email to over 100 ticket buyers. Quote, if you intend to use a car, know that your road may be barricaded. If you want to stay in a hotel, know that we may enter it. If you seek to withdraw money from a bank, know that the shattering glass may sting. If you plan on watching a race, know that your view may be obscured, not by exhaust fumes, but by the smoke of the fires we set. Know that the evacuation order may not come fast enough. The pigs in Quebec have arrested 6 people, probably for these attacks. Arrests in times of militarized policing and iron-fisted crackdowns on peaceful protests have absolutely no bearing on guilt or innocence, of course. Whether these 6 young people carried out the very necessary direct action against the Grand Prix or did absolutely nothing at all, they deserve our full and unconditional support. On the 14th of June, regarded by the United States as Flag Day, D.C. statehood activists held a D.C. flag tattoo fest and flag raising in DuPont Circle.
Okay, this prize is going to go to the person here with the biggest D.C. flag tattoo. If you think you've got what it takes to win this flag, let me see you up front.
Over here.
Elbow's not going to cut it. I just saw a whole bicep. What else do we have here? Let me see these tattoos. I can't judge it unless I see the full spectrum, people. Bring it up here. That's an entire shoulder blade. I think that's the biggest. Okay. Can anybody top a shoulder blade? Shoulder blade going once. Shoulder blade going twice. That's right, cameras. Get up here and love this DC. Get up close.
On a more serious note, here's some remarks from Eleanor Holmes Norton at the DC Flag Day event in DuPont Circle on the 14th of June.
Eleanor Holmes Norton.
Thank you. Yeah, I love DC vote for all you are doing to raise the flag, the DC flag, that is. I do want to thank the organizers for the second annual DC Flag Day.
Yeah.
My friends, there is no better symbol to raise for what we're entitled to and what we don't have. Now, we love the American flag.
We love it.
All we're asking on DC Flag Day is for the American flag waivers to love us back.
Oh.
You heard that, GOP.
They love our money.
Yeah.
The $3 billion that you, DC taxpayers, give to support the United States of America. They take that willingly, and if you don't give it willingly, they know how to get it. All we're asking for is a little DC Flag Day respect.
Respect DC.
Now, good things happen on the day you raise the flag. I've just come from the DC Appropriation Committee. Now, that's controlled by the Democrats. That's why in that bill there is a provision to keep DC from being shut down if the federal government shuts down.
Yeah.
Now, that's what they almost did to us three times last year, because they won't let our money stay in the district. The money was over there. The budget was over there. The federal government almost shut down. Therefore, we, who were no part of that fight, also would have shut down. I tell you, my friends, that means we were getting no respect. And when we raise the flag on Flag Day, we remind the Congress that there are at least two flags to respect in the District of Columbia.
That's right.
You know, it's the flag that flies over the Capitol, and there's a flag that flies over the Wilson Building. And we want equal respect. We want our money to be respected by letting us decide how to spend it. We want our full voting rights in the House, and there's another House, the Senate of the United States. And above all, we want a flag, we want to make the American flag far more beautiful. All the American flag needs is one more shining star. Give us our star, give us our rights. Thank you for all you're doing here on DC Flag Day.
That was Miss Eleanor Holmes Norton, reminding everyone it's time to end the excuses and make D.C. a state now. On the 19th of June, the National Nurses Union, Occupy Our Homes, AIDS activists, the National Organization of Women, and many others picketed J.P. Morgan Chase, demanding a Robin Hood tax of 0.5% on financial transactions. In essence, they're asking J.P. Morgan Chase pay sales tax just like you do. You may remember J.P. Morgan Chase. They are the bank that gambled away at least $2 billion of your taxpayer funds, then turned around and violently evicted Dawn Butler from 917 Maryland Avenue one day after Occupy Our Homes took over their mortgage office. One of the guest speakers at the Robin Hood tax rally was Miss Deborah Harris, also facing foreclosure by J.P. Morgan Chase.
Where I was the one that was up at Congress when Diamond was trying to get his act together to talk to the council people. I was the one, along with some of the other members of Occupy at Home D.C., that was asking him the questions and telling him, are you up here to try to give account of the money that you have lost and the money that you were supposed to take care of the people? Why don't you turn around and face me? I'm just one of the little taxpayers here that need to understand why you took my home. So We got arrested for that, but that's okay. Everything will be fine with that also. But the fact that, yes, we the tax people are the ones that are going to have to pay for all of the things that they do wrong. And I think that's unfair.
A speaker from NOW, the National Organization of Women, explained some of the benefits of the Robin Hood tax.
J.P. Morgan Chase has recently demonstrated we need this tax.
Yes.
The tax actually does two things. It just throws a little bit of sand into the machinations of gambling on Wall Street.
Right.
Need to slow down that gambling. J.P. Morgan Chase might be able to say, oops, $2 billion, and actually I think a couple of weeks later they said, oh, oops, it was more like $5 billion, and we're really sorry. They may be able to deal with that, but not every bank can tolerate that kind of loss. We need to slow down these disastrous gambling-type activities that are going on Wall Street that we know drove our economy off a cliff in 2008.
Right.
So that's the one thing that the financial transaction tax does. The other thing it does, it just raises revenue. And
we want a Robin Hood tax! No more budget cuts on our backs!
I'm Matt Kavanaugh. I am the director of U.S. Advocacy for Health Gap. We're an international HIV/AIDS organization that cares about ensuring that we can end the AIDS crisis. If I told you that within our lifetime we could end AIDS, would you do it?
Yes!
If I told you that what we need to do that is not science but money, would you demand that money?
Yes!
President Obama just the other day said that he and Secretary Clinton were going to work together to create an AIDS-free generation. That is what's within reach right now. And yet instead of being on track for that, we are on track for more HIV because what's happening? What's happening is that here in our country, we're seeing budget cuts. We're seeing hospitals close. We're seeing nurses laid off. We're seeing in this country waiting lists to get AIDS drugs in the globe, in the south of this country.
Teachers waiting.
And in southern Africa, what we see is hundreds and thousands of people sitting on waiting lists. Right now around the world, 33 million people are in need of HIV drugs. These drugs cost $80 to $100 per person per year. It's a little tiny amount of money, but internationally we don't have that money. Why? Because instead, Wall Street is not paying its fair share in taxes. So we want a Robin Hood tax! No more budget cuts on our backs! We want a Robin Hood tax! No more budget cuts on our backs! We want a Robin Hood tax! No more budget cuts on our backs!
Welcome to War of the Trees on WSQT Radio, broadcasting on 88.1 FM from the heart of occupied Washington.
There is unrest in the forest, there is trouble with the trees, for the maples want more sunlight and the oaks ignore their pleas.
In a world of corporate domination and utter ruin, whosoever shall have the courage to take direct action against those who are ruining our planet and our very lives. The 11th of June is a day on which anarchists and earth liberation activists carry out solidarity actions in the name of prisoners captured by the state for real or alleged actions in the same movement. This year, one solidarity action smashed out every window of the Washington Loggers Association's building in Olympia, Washington State. This communique was issued after the action. On the night of June 11th, in the sleepy town of Olympia, Washington, we laid waste to the Washington State Loggers Association building, breaking out all 24 of their windows and leaving the painted message, "You are never safe. Go log in hell, Circle A." Roughly a decade after the fervent period of earth liberation activity that occurred in the late 90s and early 2000s, we find ourselves in a far more hopeless situation, immersed in an ever-deepening desert. Some cling to the idea of hope, and others view this as nothing more than a deceitful delusion. Neither narrative concerns us. What truly concerns us is that the living world around us is dying, and that the strength of our heart atrophies through inaction.
How many of us feel disgust at being embedded in a concrete jungle, a suburban wasteland, an ocean of meaninglessness? How many of us mourn the yawning devastation of a clear cut? While smashing out 24 windows was only a humble act of revenge in the face of the wholesale destruction of wildlife, comrades, let us cease to be eaten up inside by our unactualized rage. This is an international call to wage war on all those who profit from the rape of the earth. We greatly embrace and encourage those whose seeds of ferocious intentions have lain dormant thus far to burst forth and raise the cities to the ground. Those cities depend on an empire, a civilization that depends on the ensnarement and suppression of a wild world of meaning and beauty. For every action, there is a reaction. So as civilization abuses and mistreats fire, fire will abuse civilization. Throughout modern history, cities have burned. Rome burned. The civilized order will come to know the true purifying power of fire soon enough. Like wildfires whipping through forests, clearing out all the dead wood, making room for new growth to emerge. Civilization will perish in a firestorm, clearing the way for life to sprout and grow unmolested. This was done in solidarity with Marie Mason and Eric McDavid, Luciana Tortuga, the Kimke Forest Defenders, all ELF and ALF prisoners and fighters, the individual tending towards the wild, still in prison Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber, and all those who acted in vengeance, in defiance, and all who got away. May you forever run free for the terrifying freedom. Long live all Earth warriors! That is the communique that was issued after the 11th of June window smashing attack on the Washington Loggers Association building in Olympia, Washington State.
Well, DNA, it's natural. It's the building block of life. And when the good Lord put it together, you know, I think he did it upright. He made lots of different organisms, a complex web of life. Each one dependent on another, and so the circle, it closed up tight. But then along came a man and a microscope, and he separated the genes. And when he put them all back together, he made lots of strange, unnatural things. And now food crops grow on the ocean floor. Cows, they grow on trees. Now the ranchers gaze while their oysters graze on grass that depends on a hormone spray in our genetically modified world.
On Tuesday, the 12th of June, the EPA held a hearing on the subject of revoking the registration of atrazine, an herbicide made by Syngenta and used on corn, which increases yields by an estimated 1%. In return for that 1% increase in corn yields, atrazine is literally pushing frogs and other amphibians to extinction. It does this by forcibly turning male frogs into transgender frogs, making them sterile in the process. That means no tadpoles, no frogs the next year, and a lot more flies and mosquitoes. You may remember Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, about the effects of massive agricultural use of DDT and other pesticides. Now there's an herbicide that threatens us with a spring that is not silent, but the very opposite, overrun with the buzzing of flies and a distinctive whine of disease-carrying mosquitoes. Here's part of the testimony of Dr. Carrie Krieger of Save the Frogs at an EPA hearing in a process that could cancel atrazine's registration with the EPA, thus banning its use.
So, it's up to you to save the frogs. And one way we can do that is to ban atrazine, one of the most commonly used pesticides on the planet, banned in the European Union since 2004, consistently turns up in American groundwater, rainwater, tap water. Numerous peer-reviewed scientific publications from laboratories around the world have demonstrated that atrazine is extremely harmful to environmental and public health. So let's talk about some of the consequences of atrazine use. And I'll say, from going to scientific conferences around the world for the past 9 years and talking to lots of amphibian biologists, the vast majority of the world's amphibian biologists agree that atrazine is extremely harmful to amphibians. Abundant scientific literature from labs around the world has demonstrated atrazine's harmful effects on an array of wildlife. Atrazine's effects on wildlife include demasculinizing and feminizing the gonads of exposed males, testicular lesions, decreased penis size, disorders in accessory sex organs, severely impaired male reproductive behaviors, impaired fertility, delayed puberty, induced abortion, reduced anti-predator behaviors, diminished growth rates, reduced survival rates, decreased cellular immunity, and increased trematode infections that result in malformations such as eight-legged Pacific chorus frogs, or even ones with 16 legs, which I've seen pictures of. So we hear lots of propaganda and lies that come from Syngenta and the pesticide lobby, and I'm sure we'll hear a lot of those today.
Dr. Krieger went on to point out that atrazine gives very little back in return for what it does to frogs.
Would those who choose to continue to spray pesticides on their corn go bankrupt due to an atrazine ban? That's unlikely, as atrazine only increases corn yield by 1 to 6%. Atrazine is an outdated 50-plus-year-old chemical. Technology can surely make up for the decreased 1 to 6% of corn if we put our minds to it. This is the 21st century, after all, not 1956. Indeed, Germany and Italy grow more corn now than they did prior to banning atrazine in 1991. Humans have successfully grown corn, sugar, sorghum, and rice without pesticides for thousands of years. With modern organic farming techniques and investment in technology and organic farming education, I have no doubt that American farmers can not only remain a world leader in food production in the absence of atrazine, but that we can grow and distribute food that is safe for human consumption and safe for wildlife.
Let's just hope the EPA listens to science and not to the lies of Syngenta. Mosquito bites itch like hell, and no frogs means the mosquitoes they won't be eating will be eating from our arms and legs instead.
Sizing McDonald's.
A Big Mac counterattack. Organic fanatics are sick of being stabbed in the back with clown fat, so we get fat with the beat, not with the meat. And we fight right back with fat funk against this fast food junk. A propaganda pumping punks calling it food. I think they're confused. A killer sweet treat to see, let loose abuse. For a fast food attitude, mad cow, cash cop mentality. Growing instant gratification, sowing seeds of slavery. It's happened up the pace of the lab rat race. The soma coma kamikaze selling pig fat as milkshakes. Border slaughter trauma, sick cows line mass graves. Serve you up a dead planet on the skin bones of slaves. Serve you up a dead planet on the skin bones of slaves.
Mass production, mass society. Everything the same, junk food, crap jobs.
The high fat intake, the high animal protein intake, the lack of these other things lead into the kind of diseases that actually kill 3/4 of us in Western societies before our time.
Yeah, this Ronnie Mac heart attack packed is manufacturing, distracting plastic package, false facts, hormone pump, disease, dumb cow pus and clown fat.
Yum.
Got truth trembling on the corporate water torture rack.
Would you like lies with that?
Or fries with beef fat? What about terrified cries of forests falling for Big Mac? Genetically modified alibis for the starving poor. Third world food stolen for Mac's first world exports. Straight to your first world first class neoliberal sat on a fat ass. Free market disaster task, I gotta ask. How much land did you steal for that happy meal? Yeah, it's a crap. Happy deal when you see the lives it killed.
Third world debt.
Yeah, it's a crappy deal when you see the lives it killed.
These are the most important issues I think that any of us have to face living our ordinary lives.
Just destroying rainforests.
Without advertising, McDonald's wouldn't exist. It's all image, and you know, if you can get behind that and expose the reality of the corporation, then you know, there's nothing left.
Just destroying rainforests.
fried lies for another colonized genocide attempt. Fat corporate cats hell bent on monoculture, madness of mayhem to rupture the structure of diversity. It's heresy, embarrasses me, the golden arch glory of monarch humanity. The greasy green feast of fearful disease meat, turning animals into cannibals and humans into sheep. You're being cloned like robots in a war machine factory, cause they're harvesting lies like they be harvesting wheat. Overworked employer, exploited, underpaid, the youth of today being waylaid into early graves. By fat corporate cats, deep fried desires, hellfires and death bars upsize, dissolving, remolding their lives in animal fat. It's a cannibal act, a criminal fact. The capital pact is stabbing you in the back. Yes, deep fried in animal fat. It's a cannibal act. The capital pact is stabbing you in the back with a criminal fact. Golden arch, idealistic, satanic, earth demolition, religion. Your monoculture style is genocide. Full scale culture assaulter like a Christian mission. Your mindshare warfare is totalitarian tunnel vision. Your mindshare warfare is totalitarian tunnel vision. It's mindfucker tucker terrorism.
Mindfucker tucker terrorism.
Research shows that the golden arches are now more recognized than the Christian cross.
Yeah, I ain't bowing down to no pedophile clown. No rape in the minds of children turning smiles to frown. So we shouting out loud with our stereo sound. Bring the whole fat evil Mac empire down.
Criticizing McDonald's.
On the 13th of June, members of Nigeria's Ogoni indigenous nation living in a D.C. area showed up at the Nigerian embassy to demand that the government of Nigeria and Shell Oil clean up the oil that they have been spilling on Ogoni land since before 1960. One of the protest organizers bluntly called Royal Dutch Shell a terrorist organization due to the thousands of Ogoni people who have died from exposure to benzene and other pollutants from the oil.
The Nigerian government and Shell have been in Ogoni exploiting the Ogoni people for, since 1958 when oil was struck in Ogoni. Since then, Ogoni has gotten nothing from the multi-billion dollars petrodollars that has been taken or extracted from Ogoni. What the Ogoni people has is only a dying environment, a degraded environment that the United Nations Environmental Programs report that came out on August 4th, 2011 confirmed. Ogoni people are drinking water that is 900 times higher in benzene than the World Health Organization's standard, even the Nigerian standard.
Wasn't the environment once referred to as being shell-shocked?
Yeah, it has been a shell-shocked land, and it remains a shell-shocked land. The government of Nigeria and Shell are in collaboration. They consciously, deliberately are doing this thing, you know, to kind of exterminate the Ogoni people. You know, currently the problem is that the Ogoni people stop Shell and the Nigerian government from taking their oil. You can't continue taking people's wealth for over 35 years and don't give them anything back. And you expect the people to just sit down and say thank you.
And instead, when people don't say thank you, their answer has at least once been hangings.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You might remember that. Ken Sirawiwa and eight other Ogoni activists were hanged by a military government in 1993 for opposing Shell's exploitation of Ogoni land.
We're trying to let the world know that Ogoni is not at peace. Ogoni want peace. And one way Ogoni can get peace is if the Nigerian government decides to be a government and not protect a company such as Shell over the Ogoni people. Ogoni people happen to be Nigerians, and Nigeria has the duty, the responsibility to protect the Ogoni people. And so we are doing this to let the world know what's going on in Ogoni, and we need justice. All we're looking for is justice. We're trying to put pressure on the Nigerian embassy to pressure the Nigerian government, because those of us here in America, Ogonis and our friends, we have the responsibility, we have the duty to pressure the Nigerian government, to also pressure, pressure the Nigerian embassy, to pressure the Nigerian government, you know, to clean the Ogoni environment. There's no two ways we can do that. We are trying to, you know, let the world hear us, let the Nigerian government hear us, that it is not only the Ogoni people at home that are crying, but the Ogoni people here in America and their friends, Nigerians and other oppressed Nigerians are crying, because anything that happened to Ogoni would serve as a kind of model, especially in environmental cleanup.
This is rather like what's going on with the Lakota people here in North America with the tar sands mining in Alberta, Canada, and the Keystone XL pipeline. Same stuff. Shell's actually worse than BP, but because they commit their crimes in Africa, a lot of people don't care.
Definitely so. And I mean, the most common of the issue is that the Nigerian government is allowing Shell to do that. Take, for instance, BP in America, the issue that just happened.
Big spill.
The big spill. The American government, because it choose to be a government, decide to hold BP accountable. But in Nigeria, that's not the case.
Yeah, what I'm guessing is that Shell takes all the garbage and the crap they wouldn't dare use in Alaska and takes it down to Nigeria to use.
They do all kinds of things. Shell is a quasi-government in Nigeria. Shell is one of the most deadliest companies in the world that you can ever think of. Shell is, I have declared Shell a terrorist organization.
It's appropriate.
It's
like combining Blackwater with Exxon.
Shell fits that description of a terrorist organization because when you terrorize the environment is man's first right. If you don't live in an environment that is secure, that is safe, you cannot live, you cannot even breathe to claim other rights, be they political, social, or economic. And so Shell is a terrorist organization so long as I and the Ogoni people are concerned.
And aren't there supposed to be procedures for cutting off money and assets of terrorist organizations?
Well, that is what we should have done. But you know what's going on in the world today where oil is important to the government. Governments around the world are so concerned about,
under the same rules applied to Al-Qaeda, there should be an embargo on all oil from Shell.
Definitely. And that's why we boycott Shell. We've been asking people to join us and boycott Shell.
I haven't bought Shell gas since 1993 after the hangings.
And that's a great thing. Thank you very much for doing that.
After about an hour and a half of the protest, several representatives of the Nigerian embassy emerged, making many promises about how the government would indeed start cleaning up the mess they and Shell made together 10 months after a UN report on the situation.
I'm going to do that this message will get to the highest level.
Expeditiously,
it will be there. And then let me also reiterate that we are on the same side. The Ogoni people are Nigerian people.
Definitely.
Here we represent Nigeria. We don't represent any individual ethnic group. And the overall well-being of all Nigerians is the overall objective of President Goodluck Jonathan. And he will stop nowhere but to see that he gets the best for the Nigerian people, including the Ogoni people. And we are very delighted, and we share the same view with you. And I'm very glad you also mentioned that Nigeria and Shell team up to see that this clean up will take place. It will take place. Don't mind the challenges. The challenges you see, the delays are the same challenges most developing countries face. We are faced with so many challenges, as you know, in Nigeria, security challenges, developmental challenges, and all that. But we are not by any means shaky in our responsibility as a government, as a people, to deal decisively with the problem.
A whole lot more words than that were spoken, all bearing the same promises. Government of Nigeria, the Ogoni people are going to hold you to these promises. To everyone else out there, if you don't believe in stealing oil, not cleaning up spills dating back as far as 1970, and hanging anyone who complains, something Shell has never apologized for, there's something you can do about it. Boycott Shell, don't buy a single drop of their blood gasoline.